Blog Talk Radio.
Excuse me, yes sir, I understand, but do you actually have the word yes in your vocabulary?
I guess it started when I was a kid. If you said I couldn't do it, I did. Always had a stubborn streak, put a wall in front of me, and I'll find a way to get around it. There was a friend who said I'd never make the team. A lot of small town talk that said I'd never leave. Oh, and you know who you are. You all played a part in pushing me on to my dream. I wanna thank everyone who ever told me no. Pack it up and get back home. It kept me going, knowing I would prove them wrong. Yeah, I knew it all along. Without them, I'd have given up a long time ago. And so, I wanna thank everyone who ever told me no. My music for a man behind the desk. He said, sorry, what you got? I just don't get it. Oh, but here I am today, standing on this stage, and I wonder even now if he gets it. Yeah, I wanna thank everyone who ever told me no. Pack it up and get back home. It kept me going, knowing I would prove them wrong. Yeah, I knew it all along. Without them, I'd have given up a long time ago. And so, I wanna thank everyone who ever told me no.
This is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason. And yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, every time I play that song, I smile. I do want to thank everyone that always told me no, because if I could go back and shake everyone's hand that told me no and smile at them and say, just look at me now, I think a few of them would be startled after they pick their jaws up off the floor. I ran our numbers today. This show just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing. And like I told the guest that I have tonight, author Eric Norway, can't wait to get started with him. This show is not about me. The show is about the listeners. It's about my guests that keep coming back, the new guests that I bring in. And the show just drives itself. And I am so, so grateful for the listeners and my guests alike, because without all of y'all, I could just sit here and talk to the wind and nobody would care. Ladies and gentlemen, this morning when I did our numbers, our show, and I don't say my show because it's our show, just on Blog Talk Radio, we are at 30,566 listeners. That's just Blog Talk. When I added up all the podcast numbers that this show goes up on, we have hit 43,689 listeners in over 70 countries. To say that I'm proud of this show is an understatement. I am over the moon with this show because it gives my guests an opportunity to be heard in places that they would not be heard, maybe. It gives you, the listener, the opportunity to get out of your comfort zone, throw away the box, and open up your heart and your eyes and your intellect to authors, musicians, and artists that you might not have the opportunity to know about. So with that being said, tonight's guest, I am so excited. We were laughing before we went live because we have a lot of commonalities. Again, his name is Eric Norway. He is an author, and he is a former Border Patrol agent. Say that fast three times. He's a retired DEA special agent and also a pilot. He currently is employed as a private investigator in the private sector, and he lives with his family and his dogs in El Paso, Texas, for the past 20 years. And before I introduce him and say thank you for being on the show, I just want to say thank you for your service, because those Border Patrol agents and those DEA agents, they are our front line, ladies and gentlemen. They're like our military and our police officers and our EMTs and our first responders and our firemen. They run in when we run out, and they keep our borders safe. They keep our streets safe. And for that, welcome, Eric, and thank you for your service.
Thanks, Savannah. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here tonight.
Well, I am so excited. I feel like I'm talking to a, if I were starstruck, if I were that type of person, I'd say I was talking to a star. It's just the things that we can talk about tonight that don't, that have a lot to do with your book, but also have to do with you and the things that I love. So before we talk about that, how did you as Eric get to be a Border Patrol agent, DEA agent, pilot? Was it something in your DNA? Was it something as a child you wanted to do? Or you just wake up one morning and say, I'm tired of corporate America, I'm going to go fight crime?
Well, it was an accident, actually. My background is aircraft maintenance. I've been crazy about airplanes since I was a little kid and wanted to fly. After high school, I joined the Army and wanted to fly, but Vietnam had just ended. They didn't need more pilots, and I wore glasses, so that was a disqualifier. Wound up going to Germany and working on aircraft over there. And after I got out of the service, I went and got my AMP license, the airframe and power plant license, and worked around California and Texas. And then in 1989, I found myself interviewing for an aircraft mechanic job for the Drug Enforcement Administration, for the DEA. They had their aviation headquarters in Dallas at the time, North Dallas. And 3 weeks later, I found myself in Bolivia, of all places, working as an aircraft mechanic and a crew chief. They had a large operation going at the time in the late 80s and early 90s called Operation Snowcat. And the idea was to go into South America and try to stop the poppy production where it's produced, you know, the actual plants, labs, and so forth. And it was very exciting. It was a lot of fun. You know, I was an aircraft mechanic by trade and wound up being down in the middle of some very interesting skirmishes, and didn't speak a word of Spanish when I went there, but you pick it up pretty quick if you want to eat. and get around and so forth. But it was there that I first met the first Border Patrol agents that I ever met. They were actually working with Operation Snowcap in Bolivia, and had long talks with them and stuff. And then I got to meet the agents, and, you know, interesting bunch of people, you know, they're impressive bunch of people. And, but, you know, after a while I figured out that, you know, the special agents, there's, you know, they're not that special. Some of them aren't that bright. And I thought if they could do that, I could do that. So I went back to school and got my degree, and, I wanted to be a D agent at the time. I was getting to be too old. There's an age limitation whenever you go in, but I finished the degree. They had a hiring freeze, but Border Patrol didn't, and the DA hires a bunch of Border Patrol agents. I got more and more interested in it as the years went by, as I was trying to prep my resume. And, you know, frankly, the Border Patrol agents told the funniest war stories when they're sitting around a campfire at night, so to speak. And so I put in for the Border Patrol and got it. I was fortunate enough to get the position. That was in 1994. And
wow.
Wound up going out to San Diego and worked out there.
As a Border Patrol agent, and I know things have escalated just in the last few years, and reading one of the reviews, and ladies and gentlemen, we'll talk about his book in a minute, but this is, to me, this ties in with his job. And I'm paraphrasing, it says, if certain parts of the book are true, they would be disturbing. And my response to that is laughable. What does the common man think goes on at the border?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you find people with all sorts of preconceived ideas. And I guess it's not just the Border Patrol or border security. Any topic that comes up, particularly if there's a political bent to it, and certainly that's a topical subject right now with, you know, the president talking about building the big wall and so forth. But people have preconceived notions about the Border Patrol. And, you know, I've had people come up and say we should just shoot them, you know, to keep them coming across. Or on the other extreme is there should be no wall and we should just let everybody in because we're peace-loving or we just should invite everybody in. And certainly the reality lies in between the two.
Well, would it be fair to say, Eric, that, okay, let's take the border wall down, and I'm not advocating that, but for the sake of this discussion, ladies and gentlemen, let's just open the borders and just let anybody wander in and out at will. Number one, the people that came to this country legally to feel safe might not any longer feel safe, because what most people don't understand is when that people come over that border, it's not just from Mexico, it's from Guatemala, it's from Syria, it's from South America, it's from parts and places half of us don't even know the name of the countries. So in theory, if it's just quote unquote Mexico, maybe, but when you've got people from all different walks of life, cultures, nefarious ideas, how can we feel safe if we don't have the front line and something to protect us?
Well, you know, I think that people didn't really pay attention to it until 9/11. And I think people actually had the fear of God put into them a lot after 9/11, you know, with good reason, certainly. You know, most of the rest of the world, certainly third world countries, have dealt with terrorism issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they believe in a secure border. And, you know, every sovereign nation has a right to control who comes in and out of that nation. You know, and the people that scream that we should tear down the wall in the United States, they don't seem to mind that Great Britain, you know, Mother England, has very stringent rules about immigration, you know, and most countries do. It's just interesting. You know, when I was in, that was in the mid-90s when I was a Border Patrol agent, that was before 9/11, and the budget for the Border Patrol was just terrible. It was piffly weak. It wasn't a matter of us catching people or really deterring people. Where I was, you know, we didn't know how many people were actually crossing, but just kind of rule of thumb, we figured that we would probably catch about half of them.
Mm-hmm.
But our job wasn't so much to prevent them from coming in. Our job was to catch as many as we could and filter out the criminals, the really bad people, and take them out of circulation, because we knew that, you know, if it's 50-50 chance they're going to get through, if we catch them more than twice, then they're just a little slower of feet or of mind. If they get caught more than that, they're all coming. You know, basically is what I'm saying. Of the thousands of aliens that I worked with, they're all here today if they want to be. But the vast majority of Mexican nationals, they're not really interested, or back then. I don't know how it is now. I mean, I kind of do, because I keep in touch with the Border Patrol, and here on El Paso, I can see Mexico from my house, and my friends are Border Patrol agents and law enforcement, of course. But the reality has changed quite a bit since I was in the 90s, but the profile back then was 90-plus percent of the people that were coming across just to be seasonal workers. And mm-hmm. I always felt there was a program called the Bracero program that ran from World War II all the way up into the early 60s, I think, where if a Mexican national would pass a background check and enter and leave the country when he was supposed to, he was invited back the next year. He would get the Bracero program card, which allowed him to come over and be a laborer. The United States needed the cheap labor, and the large percentage of the Mexican population that doesn't have much opportunity needed to work. And so
exactly.
They came across. And yeah, and certainly there's been cases where people come across. I mean, what you hear a lot on TV about the aliens are going to come take American jobs. You know, they're going to come over and get food stamps and welfare, you know, this, that, and the other. For the most part, I didn't find that to be credible after dealing with thousands and thousands of aliens, because they just want to come over and work, and they were terrified of law enforcement, terrified of officialdom, and would rather, you know, they wouldn't be caught dead, you know, trying to get food stamps or free medical care or anything like that. But there are cases certainly where people have come across, have brought their families, and they've sponged off the country, and nobody wants to see that. But at the time when I was working as an agent or a PA, a patrol agent, the vast majority, they were just coming across. It was the fathers and the sons. They come across in the spring. They work construction, agriculture, and then around Christmas time, they all go back. And you should see them when they're all southbound, headed back. You know, that's our slow season because everybody's going home instead of coming north. But you can watch them. They're going home, the fathers and sons, new Stetsons, new boots, maybe new buck knives, lots of presents for the family. They go home as heroes. They stay home, you know, November, December, January, February, and then they start coming back across, you know, for the next year. But they never had any intention of staying in this country. They just came across to work for the season and then go back home to their families.
And the sad part is the people that wanted to come over and wanted to start a new life, they were raped and pillaged by the coyotes and the drug and the traffickers, because that was easy money. So whole families would die in trucks and boxes or however else they chose to sneak them across the border.
Yeah, it just happened last week in San Antonio. You know, that truck that had all the illegals in there, and I think 12 of them. Some of them died, but yeah, the aliens, they had a rough plight, and no Border Patrol agent that I've worked with, even the most hardcore of the hardcore or the right wing of the right wing, you know, after you deal with these people, thousands of them, you know, day in, day out, really, they feel sorry for the aliens. You know, they've got a terrible plight. You know, I was lucky enough to be born in the United States of America and have a lot more opportunity than those people did, and they were having to do something about it. You know, a father's got to feed his family. And that was the best way to do it. And there was no very simple way. I mean, people say, well, do it legally. That takes years and thousands
and
of dollars.
And money.
To do it
legally.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
some people never get in.
Yeah. And the aliens, the vast majority. But it's one of the things that make it such a dangerous job is that you tend to get a little complacent when you're dealing with groups, large groups. You know, anywhere from, you know, a normal size group is probably around 10 to 20 when I was working in the canyons back in San Diego. Certainly there'd be less smaller groups than that, and certainly there'd be larger groups. There'd be groups 30 or 40 sometimes you'd start pulling out, and you're the only guy down there, but it's a volume business. If you do a volume business, you're going to get the glue sniffers and the bandits and the psychos and the crazies and the drunks and the whole spectrum of people.
And you're going to get the innocents that just want to come across, but part of them having to come across is, again, they get raped and pillaged because they have to bring drugs in.
Yeah, it's, you know, where I was, it was mostly pedestrian traffic. I was in San Diego between, if you're familiar with the geography, you've got two ports of entry out there. The biggest port of entry in the world is the San Ysidro port of entry, right there where everybody crosses to go to Tijuana to go party on the weekends and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a 10-foot metal fence, kind of a handmade metal fence that ran west to through Imperial Beach, and the fence actually goes into the surf out there. Going east from there, it goes up onto the Otay Mesa. It's a big agricultural plateau, and the next port of entry up there was the Otay Mesa port of entry. And then the fence goes through the Brown Field area, going east up to Otay Mountain. But the it's just amazing that there's thousands of people that come through here. In the 90s, 50% of all the apprehensions, right at 50, 1 year when I was there was 49, 1 year is 51%. But half of the apprehensions in the entire country at that time were coming through that corridor of this 21 miles of fence from the top of the mountain down to the surf in Imperial Beach. And then the station I worked at was between those two ports of entry. That was Chula Vista Station. And we're smack dab in the middle of it. But right at 50% of all the apprehensions came through those 21 miles, and there's just thousands coming. There's no way that we were going to stop it. Mm-hmm. We'd muster a handful of agents each night. Back in 94, I believe we had somewhere around 3,500 agents in the entire Border Patrol. Since 9/11, that's gone way up. I think there's 21,000 agents, and I think the president's talking about hiring another 5,000. That'd make 26,000 agents, whereas we used to have 3,500, you know, for the whole country. So there's no way we were going to stop these guys.
And, Eric, would it be a fair assumption to say that all 21,000 agents are not on the Mexico-United States border? Some of them are over here on the East Coast, especially down in the Keys, when people try to come in over water.
Sure, yeah. Oh, yeah, they've been able to diversify into all kinds of stuff. Marine operations, air operations, you know, after 9/11 when – the Customs Service was absorbed into the Department of Homeland Security, and mm-hmm. then Border Patrol was as well, and it became CBP, Customs and Border Protection. And they merged the two air forces together, so the Border Patrol Air Wing merged with the Customs Air Wing. And then the Customs Inspectors, you know, they worked alongside in the same company as the Border Patrol. So you had the Customs people in the ports, so you had the Border Patrol that was patrolling between the ports of entry. But it was just really rough, you know, and we would come across just terrible scenes. I used to get so infuriated, and it's not the aliens' fault, but you would have a family group that would come across, and they'd get separated. And we'd end up, you know, catching some stragglers. I'd go catch a mom and a pop, simply because they're older and slower. The mm-hmm. rest of them are in the wind, including their daughters, their 13- or 14-year-old daughters. And, you know, there's no way to get a hold of them. The father never gave a phone number for a contact amongst the family members. Thought he was going to be able to hold it all together. And we'd hold the parents as long as we could and try to find the kids. But we don't know what happens to that. You know, we just don't know what happens to those people. We ended up having to take the parents back and put them back into Mexico, but never determined what happened with the children. They're just gone. And it's just a really, really sad business. You know, it's a... they have very unfortunate lives, and they were just unlucky enough to be born as a poor Mexican national. So,
and
you know, I know that some people, listeners, are probably thinking I'm a bleeding heart. I'm really not. You know, I've almost died several times on this job, but the reality is it's not black and white. And people on the news and certainly in politics, they try to make everything a black and white issue. And, you know, you're dealing with real humans there. But again, like I said, the complacency is what gets you. There's just terrible criminals out there, terrible mm-hmm. criminals that are preying on the aliens. And you know, and plus, you know, frankly, at the point back in the 90s, if you're a career criminal, if you're a Mexican national, there's not much to steal in Mexico. You're going to come to the United States and do your crimes there because there's just more stuff to do. You know, it's much richer pickings and so forth.
And if you wind up in a Mexican jail, you can just forget it because you have no civil rights in a Mexican jail as opposed
yeah,
to here
yeah.
in the States.
Yeah,
which
it's funny. I've found it ludicrous that that a lot of politicians from Mexico or Latin America in general are so harsh on the United States and their policies when their own policies are far worse, far, far worse than ours are.
Well, you said something that I filed back in the back of my mind, and that was you were getting past the age of a DEA agent. How in the world did you get into becoming a DEA special agent if you were right there on the bubble after getting on the Border Patrol? That, to me, is very interesting.
Well the it's called Covered Service or 6C Service. I don't know what the 6C stands for, but the federal law enforcement, if you carry a badge and gun in a federal capacity, then you're covered under the same umbrella. So as long as I was in by age 37 into the Border Patrol, then I'm covered for any other federal agency. Because it's based on a mandatory retirement of 57, and they want you to do at least 20 years. So you have to be hired by a federal law enforcement agency by your 37th birthday. And I snuck in about 36 and a half in the Border Patrol. I was the oldest guy in my class. No, check that. I was the second oldest guy in my class in the Border Patrol. I was the oldest guy in my class in the DEA Academy 3 years later.
That is just – and then you said, okay, I'm done with all of that. So you started your own private investigation firm. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as a bounty hunter, there's nothing more fun to me than going out and trying to find somebody. That the hunt to me is the fun part. You know, when you drag them in or you close the, you know, you tell the people you're doing the work for, okay, they're busted. That's anticlimactic to me. I love the hunt. What about you?
Well, I loved it. I loved the Border Patrol just because it was stalking humans. And having been an aircraft mechanic, I had not been in law enforcement. I came in at middle age, like I said, late 30s when I got into it. I just took to it like a duck to water. You know, it was where we worked, and there's steep canyons. There's a big canyon complexes that runs right up to the border on the south of San Diego, south of Chula Vista. And canyons, Otay Mesa is eroding down into the ocean, you know, each rainy season, each spring. And so these canyons are probably get up to close to 300 feet deep in some areas, but they're just dark. And you just get to know those canyons. And when you're down there in the canyons and you're hunting humans, it's kind of a skill set of its very own. It's really mm-hmm. addictive. The adrenaline is very, very addictive. And, you know, you're trying to outsmart the groups that are coming through. And, you know, of course, we have some advantages. We had seismic sensors in the ground that would set off an alert whenever people went by or a vehicle would go by and so forth in different places. And so you'd have to memorize all the sensor locations. And then when you hear them being called out by dispatch, you can kind of track the group and see which way. Okay, you know, you got a group in a canyon. Which fork is he coming up to? And by the time that you learn where the sensors are, you can kind of just read and anticipate where the best place is to go cut them off. And then, you know, then we also had helicopters called mm-hmm. codename Foxtrot. We'd call in the helicopters to light up something, or sometimes we'd use the helicopters, you know, like, for example, I'd be up on the Mesa and I wanted to intercept a group. So I'd drive around north of where the group was down the canyon. I'd park and I'd slide down into the canyon and pick up a group of like 15 or 20 aliens. And then now I've got to walk them all the way back out. I can't make them go back up the cliff. I just slid down. And so I'd get Foxtrot, I'd call them up to come help me, and they'd light up the sky, you know, and they'd get down real low. It was terrifying to the aliens, a little unnerving to me. They're so loud, and they're so bright. I'd have my walkie-talkie turned all the way up with my crammed up in my ears so I could hear them, and I could talk to them, and we'd march those aliens out to an accessible spot to get back up on the Mesa and march them back up to my vehicle and then call for transport. But it was very exciting. I loved it. I just loved it. And the people I did it with, I mean, it was just a real brotherhood, camaraderie type situation, the most intense in my life. And it's the same one that you'll find amongst soldiers that are serving. Mm-hmm. I've never served in wartime. I was in Germany. But, you know, talking to these guys, and certainly when I was in DEA, it was real intense too. Probably not quite as intense as this because, you know, it was just more inherently dangerous. It was and, you know, if you're a young man, you find just the danger is kind of the buzz, too. You know, it's the adrenaline that you're getting. But it's just great fun. It's just – it was one of those jobs that was kind of mind-boggling to think about sometimes, you know, because of – it's like hide-and-seek, you know. But you're enforcing the law. It's more like almost the turf warfare thing, like a gang warfare, turf warfare. because it's my turf and you can't come on here. And I'm going to do whatever I can to keep you from coming into there. And then doing a volume business, like I said, you just encounter some bizarre circumstances sometimes, you know, sometimes very sad, sometimes very funny, sometimes tragic, you know, but it's just one of the things of the buzz. I would get so excited coming to work on a midnight shift, because that's when everything's popping, is at midnight in the springtime. Mm-hmm. And all the aliens are coming north. I just go to work just pumped. I mean, just pumped, because you just know you're going to get into something, you know. There's going to be some foot chases, some tackling, some violence, and stuff like that. And, you know, that's one of the things I talk about in the book, too, is that a lot of the stuff we used to do would look terrible on 5 o'clock news, you know, edited out.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, but it was officer safety. You know, when we were outnumbered like 100-1 down in those canyons, you had to come on like a drill sergeant. And it involved, you know, the application of very low-level violence or the threat of high-level violence just to keep everyone in check. And it would look terrible. And like you mentioned, the review in the book where he thought it was a little disturbing, it probably would look disturbing to someone that's not involved in that kind of lifestyle, that's not involved in, you know, the actual – you know, nuts and bolts of dealing with people, masses of people that don't want to be caught and will use violence to get away from you. The application of violence is absolutely positively necessary, but you're in a gray area because technically mm-hmm. you're doing stuff. You know, and I talked about other stuff in the book too. And the workflow's changed a lot. And so, you know, don't get the idea that it's going on now, because it's a lot more modified. It's not the wild and woolly days like it was back then. But, you know, for example, if you find a load vehicle out in the bushes, a lot of times the alien smugglers will pre-position a car and they'll put the keys underneath the floor mat or something like that, but they'll hide in the bushes. So the group that's coming across with the guide knows where the car is, then they'll load up and hit I-805 or I-5 and they're gone. So, you know, you're out trucking around and you find this load vehicle, what seems to be an obvious load vehicle. You run the tag and find out whether it's stolen or not. And if it's not stolen, you figure it's just a total beater. Well, maybe that car gets 4 flat tires, you know, I mean, just that kind of stuff goes on. And, you know, that's not acceptable these days. Law enforcement's changed quite a bit. And that's one of the reasons I wrote about that, was just the position that we were in. So outnumbered and, so tight.
And you had to be creative. I mean, think about it. It's 2,100 border agents and that stretch, and you got thousands of humans coming across. And like you said, you're usually on patrol by yourself. So you have to get creative and how to stop them without harming them.
Yeah, and it's technically illegal. The stuff that would happen to those cars was illegal. You know, there's just some funny things, you know, that there, when I was a brand new trainee, you know, they put you with the field training agency, FTAs, I'd be out in those canyons and me and my buddies, well, the fun thing too, the interesting thing, or one of the things I really appreciate, is that my entire class went to Chula Vista Station. We went through and the whole class went there. So my classmates, we're all still tight to this day. There's probably at least half of the guys I still talk to, you know, mostly via email and stuff like that, but, or Facebook or whatever, but, we were a tight class because we went through the entire academy thing together. And part of my book is about getting through the academy. And then we were all assigned out to Chula Vista Station. We covered all 3 shifts. It was rotating shifts. And so we just started learning from each other, hearing the war stories from each other when we'd hook up with each other. But we all became very, very close. But we'd be out with our FTA. We'd be going through these canyons. You'd find these cars that were out in the middle of nowhere, down the bottoms of these canyons, kind of burned up and stuff. And we'd ask the FTAs, it's like, oh, how did this get here? And they're like, I don't know. But, you know, later you realize that those were load cars that were taken up on the mesa, set on fire, and launched like Roman candles off the cliffs down into the canyons. I never personally witnessed that, and I was never invited. But I tell you what, I sure wish I was invited. You know, but it's one of those things where it's not commonplace, but certainly there were people doing it, and they were agents, obviously. And it just looked like so much fun. But that's illegal. You can't go do that.
You
but
can't
the alternative
do it anymore.
Is, if you find a load vehicle, what are you going to do? If you find a load vehicle in the bushes, you're going to stand there, you're going to call someone to come tow it. By that time, you can hear the sensors going off all around you. Aliens are coming. It's like a state of semi-emergency
right.
all night long. So you can't screw around and waste 2 hours sitting on a car that's worth $300, you know, the legal way, and take care of it. So just slash the tires and get on with your business, you know. That just seemed to be the more matter-of-fact, practical way of doing it. Even though I'm sure people are going, oh, my God, you can't do that, you know. But
it's
you
just
know,
a car.
It's kind of the reality.
It's, Yeah, and you haven't slashed a person. You just slashed the tires to you can pick up the people to send them back home.
That's exactly right.
That's the lesson of the two evils.
Yeah. Well, it's just part of, like I said, it was, and it's not like that now. And please don't, you know, call the Border Patrol and say, this guy was talking about the stuff you guys do. I don't think they do it anymore. You know, I've talked to people. It's, it's a much kinder and gentler, and they can do that now because they've got five times the people that we used to have, you know?
And they probably have partners now. They more than likely, they don't have to work alone anymore. And ladies and gentlemen, the name of his book is Dark Canyons. And if you've never been on the Mesa and it dark, and correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, you cannot see your hand in front of your face. So ergo, yeah, I would be slashing some tires on a car.
Yeah, it's really dark down those canyons. Everything's acoustic. Sometimes what you would get, you've got the city of Tijuana comes right up to the fence. And if you had the cloud cover, sometimes the ambient light would reflect off the clouds just enough that you could make stuff out. But otherwise, it's kind of funny, if people that are gun enthusiasts, they have the Trivium sights. A lot of guys carry pistols that had the little glow-in-the-dark sights, it's funny. Your eyes would get so used to working in pitch black that if you were up on top of the Mesa, you heard something down below, you'd look down and thinking, not sure if it was an alien or an agent, you would see the Trivium sights from the holstered pistol shine enough, go, oh, okay, that's another PA. And you could see that from 400 yards away. That's how sensitive that your eyes would get. And if a full moon was out, it was almost like daylight. You would fill out their forms. We had voluntary return forms that you had to fill out on each alien. You could do that just under moonlight, no problem, because your eyes were close to it. But on a moonless night, it is just dark, dark, dark down there. And in the deeper places in the canyon, your walkie-talkie sometimes won't hit the repeater site because you're just too far down in there. And then you're truly on your own. You're just down there on your own. There's so many agents now, and I think it's a good thing. I'm not being critical. I think the more security, and I think that with the terrorism threat that's escalating globally and certainly in this country, the more security we have, the better off we are. So I hope they hire another 5,000 agents. I hope they hire another 50,000 agents. And you still can't control the border with all those,
What people don't understand, and ladies and gentlemen, we don't want to turn, Eric or I, neither one, want to turn anyone away that wants to come to this country, but I don't want another 9/11 either, do you?
Oh, God, no. It's just, and that's why there was almost no Border Patrol presence up on the Canadian border. When I was in the patrol, everything was down on the southwestern border. But now, we've got to have that. They've had some spectacular arrests up there in Washington and in New York, catching Middle Eastern terrorist types, the Tango types. They're coming, folks. They're just coming, and we're going to have to get security. I'm afraid it's going to get worse in our country. I just think it probably will. I'm not a soothsayer. Just my personal opinion.
You've seen it.
Yeah,
you've seen it increasing over the years.
Sure. And where I was, there was almost no security. Like I said, it wasn't a matter of stopping the aliens. We were just trying to catch all we could and filter out the bad guys, get the felons out. And, I've caught aliens. Every patrol agent has caught aliens that were literally just deported the day before or 2 days before. And they're already back because there's nothing. If you take a criminal and you put them in the U.S. prison system, he eats pretty good. He gets plenty of sleep, plenty of exercise. He learns English. And then so you kick him back to Mexico. Well, if you're a career criminal, what's he going to do in Mexico? He's going to come right back to the United States because that's where everything is. That's where everything in his line of work is. The pickings are a lot richer. So, I picked up guys in California. The big supermax was Pelican Bay, and I picked up a guy once. And usually what you do is you have to pat down the aliens. You have to search the aliens, of course, before you put them in the transport vehicle. I put them up. I lean them up against a truck. I grab them by the wrist, come down, and feel if they have biceps because the aliens, the honest workers, the agricultural workers, are generally wiry and they will work all day, but they don't have big workout biceps or build, but you feel the guy's biceps and his shoulders. If he's buffed out, good chances are he's in prison. I pull the shirt up and look for the prison tabs, La Señora de Guadalupe across the back, and stuff like that. And if he is, you hook him up right now. And I picked up this guy that was just out of Pelican Bay 2 days before, basically a wild animal. By the time that you've done a supermax, you're really not that much of a human anymore. you're more of a feral animal is what you are by the time you get out. Not because he's Mexican, anybody that goes through that experience of someplace Pelican Bay, you know,
and you're
not really human. You're not sociable anymore, you know.
So let's real quick tell them what a supermax is. Ladies and gentlemen, a supermax is where the worst of the worst of prisoners go. And it's called a supermax because you've got to have the meanest, baddest guards at this prison. And it's the prisoners in the supermax have absolutely no soul and no conscience. Would that be a fair statement, Eric?
Yeah, I think so. And then just the isolation, they're all in isolation at least 23 hours a day. You know, they get out usually just so they can take a quick shower and whatever they've got to do. But, you know, I think that this would happen to any person. I think they slowly go crazy. You know, they start to lose whatever moral code that they had, if they had one before. You know, it's kind of funny. I've told people you can't rehabilitate someone that's never been habilitated in the first place.
Exactly.
But these people that if they're hardened criminals, you can't really fix that. You know, when you put them in a hole for years and years, that doesn't make them better. It makes them worse, you know. But they kick them out, they deport them to Mexico, they come straight back in. So it's, you know, you'll see it time and time again. And that's kind of what makes it a dangerous job. You know, it's border security. It's very exciting. You know, it's very adrenaline. It's very dangerous. You know, you see it rocked. We've had snipers. I've been shot at by a sniper. You know, and I felt stupid because I didn't realize what it was the first time I was talking to a guy on night shift. It was dead calm. It was fall, so we weren't real busy, but I was outside of my car talking to another guy, a supervisor, actually, and I heard this thing just kind of whiz, shoot,
bing,
like over the head. What was that? And he goes, I don't know, what was that? You know, and you hear like a little muffled gunfire from Tijuana, but that's not unusual, especially on a weekend, a Friday or Saturday night. You will gunfire once in a while. And then a few seconds later, I hear this other wing, you know, this same whizzing sound, and it bangs into the ground, you know, probably about 15 feet away from us into a rock, crack. And then you hear the gunshot, you know, a couple seconds later. It's like, holy cow, someone's shooting at us, you know. So they had to pull out of there and shut down that part, you know, and keep out of sight and stuff and call our Mexican counterparts called Grupo Beta. And, you know, they kind of rounded up the usual suspects, I guess. You know, you're talking about how the aliens is not just from Mexico, but, you know, the vast majority are from Mexico, but you get people from all over the world. You know, we get Russians and Chinese and Vietnamese, and I picked up a guy from Angola, real dark. He was black, but he was a real dark black, like you see the people from Africa. But he spoke perfect Spanish because his dad was a Cuban soldier that Castro had sent over to Angola to help with the revolution or whatever, trying to revolutionize that. And the guy spoke perfect Spanish, so he was easy to
he blended
to work. Yeah, but I picked up an Irish guy, you know. I mean, you just pick up people from all over the world. I had a drunken sailor come across who was an American. He went over, got drunk. He walked through the worst part of town, came across. I was sitting in my truck, and I just see this drunk guy walking down the fence road, and I'm thinking, man, a drunk alien, I don't want to deal with that. But I went cruising up, and it was this sailor, totally drunk. It's like, which way is the United States? It's like, you are in the United States. Put him in my truck, took him back around. Yeah.
It's a good thing that he ran across you, or he wound up in a Mexican jail.
Well, he could have, yeah. But, you know, he had plenty of money. I know he had money because he kept trying to – he was so loaded, he was trying to shove money at me for me to take him back to his base. It's like, no, I can't take you back to your base. But I can show you, you know, I'll put you where the trolley – when the trolley starts running in the morning, you can take it. This is like 2 o'clock in the morning, and the trolleys don't start running till like 5 in the morning, something like that.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, it was a funny story, you know. And he had walked through absolutely the worst part – I mean, the part of town, Colonial Libertad, which was just notorious for messing with, you know, just clipping the wings of the aliens, the migrants, as they're coming through, because, you know, everybody's trying to make money off these poor aliens.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to make money off of them. But this guy walked right through the worst part of it into the United States, squeezed through a hole in the fence, came across, and just happened to run into me. And even funnier, I took him down to the – I'm sorry?
I said God was with him that night.
He was truly with him that night. You know, I took him back down to the port of entry, San Ysidro port of entry, and said, sit on that bus or that bench. The bus of the trolley will start running in the morning. And there was a cop down there. San Diego PD always has a presence down there. I said, hey, man, it's a sailor. Can you just kind of keep an eye on him? And then so later I came back, and the guy was gone. And I get off that morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, 7:30. I'm driving back home up Interstate 805, and there's that sailor about – 4 miles up the road walking down the side of the highway. So I pulled over and said, man, you're going up the wrong highway. You need to go up Interstate 5, not 805. Get in my car. So I took him back to the base, and he wasn't drunk anymore. He was just really angry. He didn't remember me. You know, I was trying to explain to him what had happened. He was so out of it, but that's a lucky guy. You know, there's no doubt.
Well, before
that
we run out of time, well, speaking of your book, we're going to, that was a great segue, because we're going to run out of time if we don't talk about your book for a minute. So tell the folks, the name of the book, ladies and gentlemen, is Dark Canyons. And what is this book about, Eric? I mean, to me, it's an amazing book. I can't wait to dig into it.
Well, it's a set of stories. When I first retired, I sat down to write a bunch of the little vignettes that happened to me, the little stories, short stories of what I witnessed, was involved in, or heard from other agents, other credible sources. And I wrote down a collection of these stories, and then I turned it into a fictional novel. I used a couple of my classmates as the characters in the book, and kind of made a fictional background, one from Vermont, one from El Paso. They became fast friends in the academy, and then they went out together with the class to San Diego. The guy from El Paso, he's just in love with his wife and his twins, and he's just trying to make it all work. And his best friend, the guy from Vermont, kind of falls under some bad influences and kind of goes bad, starts using methamphetamine and so forth. And they wind up being pitted against each other towards the end of the book. I tried to keep it nice and fast and quick. I've gotten some really good reviews on it, but it's a good story. But the things that happened to them, all the stories about the academy and the stories that happen out in the field, those are all little true stories. You know, those are real things that actually happened. But I use the fictional thing as a vehicle to, I enjoyed it. It was a good book. My classmates, a bunch of them have read it, and I've gotten some pretty good reviews. Tried to keep it nice and quick, you know, and going through. But right off the bat, let me put out a disclaimer. I've never met anybody that used methamphetamine while they were a law enforcement officer. This is just part of the book, you know.
Just part of the story, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, you know, I was kind of wondering, you know, I took a class. I want to throw out some credit to Elsie Hayden. She's my writing instructor. She's the one who's helped me through and helped me produce this book. Actually, her husband is quite the formatter. He's helped actually turn it into a book. And Elsie's been on your show before.
Yes.
As a matter of fact. And she's just a wonderful human being. I mean, I guess she took pity on me because I just showed up in this collection.
And she hooked us up. Yeah, she hooked you and I up.
Yeah.
I'm so glad she did.
Yeah, I retired and I wanted to do some writing. I'd been doing investigative writing my whole DA career, and I wanted to do some writing like this. And, you know, so I go join her class. It's just a class that's sponsored by the El Paso Community College. It's just one of those life enrichment classes, and I'm so glad I met her. But, you know, we start off with poetry. I'm thinking, poetry? Poetry? Me? I can't write poetry. There's no way. I know I've got this book I want to write. But, you know, it was just so good for me to do all the different various homework assignments that she had, because it's good mental gymnastics and mental discipline. And it helped my writing tremendously. And I just got to give a shout out to Elsie. She's just a wonderful, wonderful person. And I wouldn't have a book if it wasn't for her to kind of show me the way, you know, and that's what she's done for so many other, you know, budding authors. But the other reason I didn't write it as a true collection of stories, because, you know, technically I'd need to get permission from the Department of Homeland Security to write a true story about the Border Patrol. And there's no way that, what would they have to gain as opposed to lose for me to publish a true story about, you know, trash and ride vehicles, alien vehicles, and some of the low-level violence techniques you had to use to keep control, crowd control, and so forth. They don't want to have nothing to do with that. But, you know, I turned it into a fictional novel then. Just, you know, that was one of the reasons. But it was good. And then there's some stuff in the background that involves my DEA. My DEA career, you know, worked some of the drug cases into that as part of the background of the two gentlemen come from, the two characters come from. So, but that's what it is. It's a really good, it was a real good exercise for me. I really enjoyed the book. There's another, you know, one thing I can put out to your audience of people that are new authors that are interested. Elsie and her husband, Richard, encouraged me to seek out a professional editor. And I can't not stress hard enough how important that is to get someone with a professional set of eyes to help you turn your manuscript into a readable product. And I went on this website called Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R, Fiverr, and worked with a woman whose name online is Kit, K-I-T, Kit 56. And I gave her over 600 pages of manuscript, and we went back and forth, and she chopped huge chunks of it. It, like, hurt my soul. I mean, I was like, I said, Kit, you know, the stuff you're chopping, I almost died in that. That's really important to me. And the lesson that she drove home to me that I learned from this process is it's not about the author. It's not about your book. It's about the reader. You know, it's what you're presenting to the readers. And such an important lesson, you know. And she says, save it for the sequel. And I was like, sequel? I'm just trying to get a book, you know. But she's just a wonderful person. She was a good editor. She didn't touch a single bit of it. She just put the footnotes in the side and went through and would say, you know, yeah, you use the word the 18,000 times. You need to knock that off. You know, we need to go through and take all that stuff out. And just very, very good, but just brutal in her editing, but made it a very good book because of her of the way that she handled it. So kind of a shout out to Kit. If Kit ever listens to this, I can't thank her enough either. So it's been a lot of fun, and I'm working on another couple of projects right now. I really enjoy the process, but I think that for anybody that's interested in the Borg Show, it's, like I said, it's a topical subject. My novel takes place in the 90s, so a lot of the stuff has changed, of course, in the last 20-something years. But it's still a topical subject. Border security is as important today as it's ever been in our history, I believe. And God bless U.S. Border Patrol.
Amen, and God bless you for taking that step to keep us safe, because not only did you join the service, but then you did the Border Patrol, and then you went into DEA Special Agency. And ladies and gentlemen, that is a dangerous, dangerous job. We all know what happened to the Border Patrol agent with the Fast and Furious. And sometimes we kill our own people because we're not very bright. Or we give other people the means and the opportunity to kill our agents because we're not very bright. So if you know a Border Patrol agent, if you know a police officer, if you know a first responder, if you know someone in service, thank them for their service, because, like I said at the beginning of the show, without them, we would have anarchy. Trust me. Now, you are working on two books. One is a true crime, and another one is fiction, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm writing another novel, be a fictional novel, but based on true events that from working cases here in El Paso for the Drug Enforcement Administration, and particularly it's going to kind of point at the cartel wars. You know, there was this terrible, terrible wars when the Sinaloa cartel invaded the Juarez cartel, or took on the Juarez cartel and tried to take over northern Chihuahua. The worst parts of it was from 2008 to 2012. It was just horrible, horrible. Thousands of people were killed in Juarez, right across. I mean, I've heard the gunfire. We've had people in El Paso actually shot by just random bullets coming from the firefights and the executions going on down in Juarez. It was just terrible. It was a terrible time. But that's a novel, and there's another novel I'm working with two other guys. Well, it's a true crime story about a Green Beret major in El Paso in 1977. January 1977, he was killed, actually, by his estranged wife and his oldest son. They killed him. But it's a fascinating story. The guy was a super trooper. He had won the Silver Star, 6 Bronze Stars. He had won the Distinguished Service Cross, Distinguished Flying Cross, and he was a non-aviator. You know, he's just a super trooper. And in Vietnam, killed scores of Viet Cong, was a Green Beret guy that was attached to South Vietnamese units, military units that were working up close to Cambodia. Comes back a hero. The war ends. He's reassigned to El Paso, put in charge of a training brigade, and then his life kind of unravels. But it's just a fascinating, fascinating story. His name is Chester Garrett, and a friend of mine that I've done casework with was, he's also retired, but he was a detective, a crimes against person, homicide detective with the El Paso Sheriff's Department, and he picked it up as a cold case. You know, they had already suspected the family members, but there were other issues that were going on. And it's all very fascinating, you know, but between the CID, the Department of Defense's Criminal Investigation Division that were doing the investigation because he was a military person, then you've got the Sheriff's Office that's doing their investigations because they found the body out in the county, and then you had the FBI involved because of the federal aspect of it. It just got really screwed up. The initial investigation got pretty screwed up, and then my friend Tony Adias came in and picked it up as a cold case and got a conviction on both the wife and the son just about 4 years ago. So it was definitely an old case that he picked up, and they're both basically serving effective life sentences in the Texas prison system. But it's
can't
a fascinating story, you know, the twists and the turns. It's something else.
I cannot wait to read it. You're not going to believe this, but we're going to run out of time. I'm serious. We've got like 3 minutes left.
It's been such a fast hour. Thank you so much. I can't believe how fast the time did go by. I really enjoyed it.
Tell the folks where you can be found.
It's on Amazon. It's on the Amazon Books, Dark Canyons. My name is Eric Norway. There's some reviews if you want to check it out. It's on Kindle for $2.99, or it's $11.99 for a hardback copy. I'm also on Facebook, Eric Norway. If you'd like a signed copy, just drop me a message, and I'll be glad to send one of those to you through the U.S. mail. But thanks for listening to me. I've really enjoyed this experience. Thank you, Yvonne. It's been wonderful.
Well, and you're coming back. We already talked about that. In fact, I want to bring you back in March, because by March you should have at least one of those books out. No, ladies and gentlemen, y'all cannot go get his book now because we're not done yet. We still have a couple of minutes. You know, they will. They're fickle, dude. I don't know about them. You have been. I'm just sitting here with my mouth open, listening, just soaking it up like a sponge, because we talked before the show, and this is like honey out of a honeybee hive for me. It's just like nectar from a fruit, because this is my passion and I love it, and especially true crime, because we are the voice for those victims. They have no voice, and so we have to be their voice.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of times, and by the time that sometimes the media spin on it, I think the criminal gets more sympathy,
absolutely,
you know, than the victims do. The victims are forgotten because they've been silenced, you know, and
yes.
You know, it's law and order. It's always a balance. You know, the pendulum is always swinging back and forth between anarchy or totalitarianism, but you've got to find a happy medium, and there's some place where you can provide security for people without trampling on personal rights. It's just people get a little wound up about the extremes, about the limits, you know, that you want of either side of the camp that you're in.
But we're going to bring you back. We'll bring you back in March and talk about this some more. And ladies and gentlemen, I expect every one of y'all to be here. And y'all know at the end of every show, this is what I say. Don't just feel special. Be special. Because if you say, well, I feel special today, you're not special. You have to say, I am special. You be special. And if you want to achieve greatness, please stop asking permission, because nobody's going to give it to you.
That's right.
You just have to go out and
get it.
And your smile is your logo, ladies and gentlemen. Your personality is your business card. And how you leave others feeling after having had an experience with you, that becomes your trademark. And I hope, Eric, that you have had as a wonderful experience with me as I have had with you.
I sure have. Yeah, this was a lot of fun, and it's a lot easier to verbalize or give opinions in a forum like this as opposed to a foreword in a book. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to express my personal opinions.
Well, you're quite welcome. Thank you for feeling free to do it. It makes me very happy because I like it when people are comfortable enough to be able to do that, because that's why we call it Off the Chain. That's why I don't do a scripted show. So, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, author Chris Fay will be here, and we will talk with her. Saturday night, I may do an open mic night. I may take the night off. Just depends on what kind of mood I'm in, because my guest, he's got some conflicts, but we'll be bringing Kyle Perkins, but we'll be bringing him back in March. And definitely, Eric, please come back and be a regular on the show, because you have so much to offer.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I'd be glad to come back. Absolutely.
Sweet. And see, ladies and gentlemen, this was his first show, and he wasn't that nervous. He thought he was going to be nervous. But, you know, we're the kind of folks around here. We make everybody at home. That's why they call us Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason. This is Off the Chain, and we hope you will join us tomorrow night with Chris Fay. And go out there and shake a hand. Shake a first responder. Shake a border patrol. Shake police officer, shake a service personnel, because they are our front lines and we love them. And with that being said, my guest, Eric Norway, and I wish you all a wonderful, wonderful evening and hope that you will join us again tomorrow night at 8 o'clock here on Off the Chain, because you never know what's going to happen. Okay, we're off the air, but anything we say is gonna will go up in the archives. It's sort of like the bloopers at the end of the movie. You watch the credits roll by, sure. You get up to leave, and but I wanted to reiterate.
Thank you so much. I just loved it. Yeah, thank you.
Well, you are quite welcome. You are entertaining, informative, and educational, and it's so well rounded. There's a passion in your voice that just comes right through. That I could just sit and talk to you for 2 hours and never get bored.
I'm just amazed how fast the hour went. I mean, literally, I thought we were only about 15 minutes into it, and you're saying we're almost out of time. And you're right. I guess once you get kind of spooled up, I kind of go down the direction. I'll tell you a million more war stories, but I guess I'll save it for next time. No.
See, we'll never run out of anything to talk about on the show with you because there's and the thing about it, Eric, is not only are we talking about the book, which I can't wait to get, but we're finally have a doorway, if you will, to educate people about the border, about the importance of a border, the importance of having the color of law at the border, and what happens if we don't have a border. And we can't go into Mexico and behave like we have allowed the aliens, illegals, to come here. We'd wind up in a Mexican jail, never to be heard from again.
That's
right.
So
people need to. Yeah. So we have so much to talk about. Lord, I could bring you back for the next 52 weeks and we'd never run out of stuff to talk about.
Well, thank you. I did enjoy it.
You are so welcome, my friend, and I cannot wait to get you back because the border is definitely a hot button. It is something that people need to be educated about and need to be discussed with about without them going off on the deep end and getting their panties in a wad and puffing up like a bullfrog. They need to be educated, they need to be informed, and they need to understand that it is because of the border that we stay semi-safe.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
And with that being said, my new friend, and I will get this up to you as soon as it goes up into archives, I'll send you the link. I want you to put this out everywhere. This is my gift to you. And then tomorrow when I put up the 5 podcasts, I will also send those to you in the link. And those are my gifts to you to use as a tool to promote yourself and to get the word out there and to let people know that you've got a great book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Yvonne. Thank you so much. I'm really grateful to Elsie. She's such a marvelous person, such a wonderful person. And now I just owe her that much more for introducing me to you, you know. So.
Well, we can't pay it back, but what we can do is pay it forward. And that's what Elsie and I strive to do is because people have helped us down through. I published my first book, Eric, in 2006, and that was before – indie authors were accepted. People still read us holding their nose. So there was a group of us that broke this glass ceiling and said, okay, we're out there and we're not going anywhere. And the big six now are afraid of us, which is fine with me because we introduced people to eBooks. We introduced people to videos, to trailers, and the big six were still scratching their heads because we have to market ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And they used to have the market completely sewn up.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the magic of the internet and self-publishing and Kindle and all that is just it's allowed people to express themselves without, you know, sending in copies, getting agents and trying to send in copies, manuscripts that just get turned down and never read or whatever.
Yep.
So I think it's wonderful.
And we are us as indies, we are a network. We're a tight network of individuals that work together as a unit to help each other to advance.
Yeah. Yeah, and boy, am I grateful for that.
Well, my darling friend, as soon as I get back to my other desk, I will set you a date up for March and see if that's okay with you. And thank you once again. It's an honor and a privilege to have you on my show.
thank you so much. It was a very positive experience.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, and it will be even more fun next time.
Okay, thank you.
All right, darling, talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye.